The following presentation was recorded at the 2013 Conservative Anabaptist School Board Institute. More information at thedocforlearning.org.
As you're getting ready for the workshops, we'd like to some kind of an idea what size the workshops would be so they could set that up. So I think we'll take care of that next. We'll have those who are going to do the workshops immediately following Levin's talk on vision for school with purpose. We'll go ahead and take those counts right now, and we'll also have the those of you who are responsible to give those workshops to stand and give a little short presentation of what those workshops will be. Practical steps to building your budget with all school support. Leland, where are you?
Greetings to everyone. It's a pleasure for me to be here and take part in this event. You know, I was just thinking if this group here today were our congregation, if this were our church, if Gerald Miller were our school teacher, our school board chairman, and Jonas Sauter would be our school teacher, we would have probably a very interesting community. And we'd probably have a very strong school, and we probably wouldn't have this topic. Because by your presence being here with us today, we know that you're interested in school and that your support is there. And for some of you, you've traveled a ways to get here. We know that you're willing to put some money into the school. We would have no problem funding our education programs. And we know that as we, in our communities, life gets pretty real, doesn't it? We get into the humdrum of life, and we find ourselves preparing for next year and being concerned about being able to raise the funds that we need for our school. And it seems like if you're on the school board raising funds for the school, there's very few people that really seem to spend much time shedding tears over this topic and really concerned about it. And that's the school board, and if you're a church-funded school, the deacons. And so it's up to you two to see to it that that this happens. Now, I do realize that we have a very broad, from what I have seen and heard, segment of schools here, and our experiences can be very different. Our school is a small school. We have a small church. We have around 20 students, and I've been talking with some of you here that talk about in the hundreds. And so there's our experience is varied in what we face in this. So to me, it's not so much maybe the size of the school as it is what the cost per student might be. Where do we start with this dilemma? I think starting with just doing a investing more energy into dealing with the funds themselves is maybe not where the problem lies, especially in knowing our people. Knowing how we work, we seem to have the money for the things that we're interested in. We find the time and the resources to do what really matters to us. So are we saying that maybe school doesn't matter as much to us as what it should? And when I say us, that's probably not the group that's sitting in this room. And if school does not matter much to you, and you're in this room, I would love to talk to you after this session. What happens? Life is real. Life is real. We face a lot of difficulties in life. We face a lot of trouble in life. And you know, people are not perfect. Our circumstances are not perfect. Let me share a little story with you. It's the blueberry story. The teacher gives the businessman a lesson is the title. If I ran my business the way you people operate your schools, I wouldn't be in business very long. You can see already this is a businessman speaking here. I stood before an auditorium filled with outraged teachers who were becoming angrier by the minute. My speech had entirely consumed their precious 90 minutes of in-service. Their initial icy glares had turned to restless agitation. You could cut the hostility with a knife. I represented a group of business people dedicated to improving public schools. I was an executive at an ice cream company that became famous in the middle 1980s when People magazine chose our blueberry as the best ice cream in America. I was convinced of two things. First, public schools needed to change. They were archaic selecting, sorting mechanisms designed for the industrial age and out of step with the needs of our emerging knowledge society. Second, educators were a major part of the problem. They resisted change, hunkered down in their feathered nest, protected by tenure and shielded by the bureaucratic monopoly. They needed to look to business. We knew how to produce quality, zero defects, continuous improvement. In retrospect, the speech was perfectly balanced. Equal parts, ignorance and arrogance. As soon as I finished, a woman's hand shot up. She appeared polite, pleasant. She was, in fact, a razor-edged veteran high school English teacher who had been waiting to unload. She began quietly. "We are told, sir, that you manage a company that makes good ice cream." I smugly replied, "Best ice cream in America, ma'am." "How nice," she said. "It's rich and it's smooth. 16% butterfat," I crowed. "Premium ingredients?" she inquired. "Super premium, nothing but triple A." I was on a roll. I never saw the next line coming. "Mr. Vollmer," she said, leaning forward with a wicked eyebrow raised to the sky, "when you are standing on your receiving dock and you see an inferior shipment of blueberries arrive, what do you do? In the silence of that room, I could hear the trap snap. I was dead meat, but I wasn't going to lie. I send them back. "That's right," she barked, "and we can never send back our blueberries. We take them, big, small, rich, poor, gifted, exceptional, abused, frightened, confidential, homeless, rude, and brilliant. We take them with ADHD, junior rheumatoid arthritis, and English as their second language. We take them all, everyone. And that, Mr. Vollmer, is why it's not a business. It's a school." In an explosion, all 290 teachers, principals, bus drivers, aides, custodians, secretaries jumped to their feet and yelled, "Yay, blueberries, blueberries." And so began my long transformation. I have been blamed as a school board chairman of trying to run our school like a business. For those of you attending the next session, we will talk about that a little bit more. I do confess, I think like a businessman. I am a businessman, and that's just how I think. I can't help that part. However, I do have a deep burden for our schools. And when I see our schools not getting funded by our businessmen, by the people in our community, and as was said this morning, most of us are businessmen, small or large. If our schools are not getting funded, there must be another reason. And so let me suggest to you that our schools not getting funded appropriately, or that being a difficult issue, is probably one of the smallest side effects of the problem that is going on. And therefore, the main thrust of this part of my topic is not so much about the money as the lack of vision. I thoroughly have enjoyed the morning. There has been a lot shared already. And I realize with the lineup of speakers that you have here, there's vision seems to be very central to the theme in this event. And so we find some overlap that happens here. And I did not know what the others were going to share when I was preparing for this. So where we overlap, I apologize for that. Those of you that have a Bible, turn with me to Psalms. And I find it amazing that the brother already read these verses this morning. Psalm 78. Excuse me. Psalm 78, verses 3 through 6. Which we have heard and known, and our fathers have told us, we will not hide them from their children, showing to the generations to come the praises of the Lord and his strength and his wonderful works that he hath done. For he established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers that they should make them known to their children, that the generation to come might know them, even the children which should be born, who should arise and declare them to their children. And I'll turn with me over to Proverbs. Proverbs is a very special book to me. I use it a lot in finding guidance and direction for the daily struggles that we face in business. And Proverbs, the key word in Proverbs is wisdom. And one way that we could explain wisdom is the ability to live life skillfully. To live a godly life in an ungodly world. This is no simple assignment. Life is real. We face many challenges. In chapter 2, verse 1 through 11, my son, if thou wilt receive my words and hide my commandments with thee, so that thou incline thine ear unto wisdom and apply thine heart to understanding, yea, if thou criest after knowledge and liftest up thy voice for understanding, if thou seekest her as silver and searchest for her as for hid treasure, then thou shalt understand the fear of the Lord and find knowledge of God. For the Lord giveth wisdom, out of his mouth cometh knowledge and understanding. He layeth up sound wisdom for the righteous. He is a buckler to them that walk uprightly. He keepeth the paths of judgment and preserveth the way of the saints. Then shalt thou understand righteous and judgment and equity, yea, every good path. When wisdom entereth into thine heart, and knowledge is pleasant unto thy soul, discretion shall preserve thee, understanding shall keep thee. In one of the songs that we sang, it said only, if I remember the words correctly, only the Lord can inform the mind and purify the heart. And I think if we lose a vision of what we're really trying to accomplish in school, what school is really about, what our whole education program is really about, we start to stray. This is the first thing that we start losing out on. Only the Lord can inform the mind. I love the presentation that was given this morning on math. It brought math alive. Math is so that we can worship our Creator and we can be good stewards over the things that He has given us here. Excellent presentation. School is a community effort. Every one of you here comes from a community, small or large. And in the community, we have the church. The body of Christ should be our central experience as a community. And outworking out of our brotherhood experience, of course, our church is made up of families. Our families are involved in businesses, are involved in organizations, in missions, in our schools, in our programs. But getting just very simple, we're just involved in life. We got the daily challenges of life that we face. We get up in the morning and there's things to do today. Very simple things. The bed needs to be made. The floor needs to be swept. The cows need to be milked. The barns need to be built. Many things that need to be done. And the pressures that we face, and the bills need to be paid. And somewhere along the way, during the week, why we need to think about the money that we're going to lay aside for the offering that's coming up for the school budget. Or if you're a tuition-based school, at some point you make the conscious decision to pull out this money to send your children to school. So for those of us that have children in school, I have six in school. Our oldest is in her last year of high school. And this is a very real thing for me, the cost of putting our children through school. Someone has to pay for that. And in our communities, in the daily life that we go through, and the younger generations coming on, let me ask you, how many 17-year-olds and 18-year-olds, when they're thinking about that car or that truck they want to buy or about that new gun that they want to buy, how many of them are thinking about the day that they need to put their first grader in school for the first day? They're not thinking that. Hence, when they get to that age, they're not prepared. Let me ask you, where is our gray hair educating the 17-year-olds and the 18-year-olds and helping them just connect some very simple dots? When you get ready to take your first grader to school, and looking over the audience, I suspect that there's many of you that have went through this experience. It's a hard day for parents. At least it was for me. It caused tears. It was, here's my little child. I'm going to drop him off at school for this. What's going to happen? And we heard this morning of how many hours the teacher gets to spend with our children. And so if you were like me, I was concerned about the teacher. And so my mind starts thinking about all the things that I might not like about the teacher. Well, this teacher has this negative trait and that negative trait, and you know, it's probably going to rub off on my student. And if I allow my mind to go down that path, I'm going to be a, I should let one of the teachers or the board here tell me what kind of a parent. If you're involved in school, those kind of parents are very difficult to deal with. My wife and I resolved when we took our first grader to school the very first day that we were not going to do that. Instead of finding fault with our teacher and seeing everything that was wrong with him, because trust me, there were some things wrong there. Very good teacher, but there was problems. But wait, is that what we need to dwell on? And you know, life is real. You know, I got to thinking, you know, so if I were the one to choose the teacher for my child, who would I choose? And I suddenly, for the first time, it dawned on me the dilemma that a school board faces in hiring teachers. The school board is not only hiring the teacher for their own first graders, they're hiring the teachers for everyone, all the parents that send their children to school. That's a heavy decision. And, you know, I'm young, much younger than I think pretty much everybody else in the room. And the teacher pool that we have the pull from to hire teachers is your students from the past. Did you ever stop and think of that? Now it's our turn up to bat. The children that we're putting through this school, those are the teachers of tomorrow. Go on down the road, the preachers of tomorrow, the community leaders of tomorrow. I think that a lot of the problem of funding our schools does not happen when a family, when a husband is 35 years old and he's struggling financially. The problem happened, it started all the way back in first grade. There was a mindset that was built up in that child's mind about finances, about the kingdom, about what's important and what's not important. And when his first grader was ready to go to school, he wasn't prepared. Granted, there's things and there's times that we have financial setbacks. There's things beyond our control. But that's not the norm. God has given us many good gifts and talents amongst our groups. Our businesses, our people find ways to fund and finance about every project that you can imagine. If you would just do a survey of how many missions and organizations are represented in this group right here, I'd say it would be astounding. There's quite a few leaders here. Leaders tend to be involved in those projects. Somehow, we find the money for them. Yes, maybe always difficult. Maybe it's always the funds are just in time. Maybe they're a little short. But if we would put together the combined amount of funds that are available for the programs represented in this room, it would blow your mind. An astounding figure. Yet our schools suffer. One of the things that I noticed early on, as I started thinking about school, and I before I even got married, I noticed that it was common to hear that our teachers don't get paid good enough. I would like to see a raise of hand of how many teachers we have in the room. Oh, wow, we got quite a few teachers in the room. Okay. And now I would like to... Oh, wait a minute. That might not be safe. Okay. you know where I was going. You know, how many teachers really get paid good? They get paid what they should get paid. How many of you have heard the argument, well, you know, teachers, that's kind of a VS position. Have you ever heard that? Okay, how many of you agree that the teacher should be, and I know there's a time when that's appropriate, and there's a time when that's okay, but on an ongoing basis where that's our platform of operation, that our teachers, that's a VS position. How many would agree that that's the way it should be? I knew you wouldn't have the nerve even if you thought so. How many of you think we should pay our teachers well? Oh, I like that. Okay. So now how many... Well, maybe that one's not safe to ask either. How many... So what happens? There's a disconnect in our minds between what we think we should do and what we actually do. So where is that disconnect? What is happening? Education is at the heart of our churches, our organizations, our missions, and our businesses. How many businesses are represented here that have more than 3 employees? Okay. More than 2 employees. Okay? We have a lot of businesses represented here. Let me ask you businessmen a question. When you hire employees, do you ever hire ex-students? Some of you do? Okay. What do the rest of you hire? Teachers, take note. When you are teaching and you're preparing your students, you're preparing the future employees, churches, ministers, pastors. When you're having ordinations, how many of you are willing to ordain ex-students? Can't get around it. Our organizations. If you're involved in some type of an organization of any kind that would come within either a not-for-profit or a 501c, raise your hand in any way if you're involved. Amazing amount of hands. Your people, the people that come, the staff that you need to recruit, they're all ex-students. You see where I'm going? All of us, in one way or another, are dealing with what happens at school. We're working with the product that came through our schools. Since there's so many businessmen here, I'm going to ask this question. How many of you love to invest well? I see a raise of hands. Looks like every businessman loves to invest well. So if you don't think that your school's doing a very good job, do you invest there? I'm not going to ask you to raise your hand. That'd be too embarrassing because there's probably somebody else in the room that knows you. But that's a reality of life that we sometimes wish that we could get away from. And we hear it sometimes even preached across the pulpit, and it should be. But, you know, this is something that it's just real life. If people don't really believe in the program, it's going to be difficult to have the support. People are not opening up their wallets and blessing the work. Yeah, they'll pray for it. I don't cost much. What a carnal mindset. What's happening in our Anabaptist communities? And in asking that question, I realized that my perspective is very, very narrow. Born and raised in a coffee farm in Costa Rica and lived south and the west most of my life, Pennsylvania is foreign territory to me. I drive through these valleys, and it doesn't fit in my mind how you folks think. And I see some of the big schools, and I drive up to this building, and I thought I was in England. So different from what I've experienced. Growing up on the mission field, on the frontier, there wasn't buildings like this. There wasn't the infrastructure from years and years. We had to figure things out from scratch. Nothing wrong with this. I love old buildings like this, and maybe it's a new building. I don't even know. But there's infrastructure here that's been here for years. There's infrastructure in your communities that has been here for years. And so I realize that there is a broad level of experience represented in this room. And so some of the things that I say might seem somewhat out of context, because I'm sure here in Pennsylvania you have no problem funding your schools, and you probably have no problem getting all the support that you need from your congregations. And I really do believe that that's probably the case in some of your schools. But I keep hearing, I travel fairly extensively, and I keep hearing this same dilemma over and over. So it leads me to believe that there is something happening in the Anabaptist community, that early on there was a lot of vision and passion that went into building our schools and to building the infrastructure that it takes for this, and the transition from the public schools to the Christian day schools, having our own schools. And I bless those gone before us that have put the work in to make this happen. But the work that it took to get our children out of public school and bring them into our Christian day schools, and to get our Christian day schools where they have, replicating just that experience, is that going to take us through the next 50 years? I think that's a serious question that we should be asking ourselves. And I am blessed to see gentlemen such as Jonas Sauter here, a man with much experience, many years of teaching, and that he has the foresight and the vision to see that of what might happen over the next 50 years. I was having a conversation with one of you over lunch of what might really happen over the next 50 years. Some of the modern thinking that we see coming across, he said maybe it's even going to be hard to maintain a concept that you have four walls and that you put the children in there with a teacher. Way different learning concepts that are starting to float across. I think he also was the one that mentioned that for one, was it a high school? They didn't even buy them any curriculum anymore. They just gave them all laptops or iPads. You know, maybe technology has a place in what we're doing, but are we thinking about where we're going in the future? Okay, so let's bring it back to practical now. The vision and the mission, the understanding as a group where we're going, and bringing that and helping the whole group, the whole brotherhood, really grasp the vision and the mission of our school. Why are we here for? If we want that to be clear, we're going to have to articulate that clearly, and we're going to have to demonstrate that. About 4 years ago, there's a number of us, as a school board, we got together and we were concerned about what was happening in our school. We had a really, really good teacher, but it seemed like the burden and the vision for a school was dying out. And maybe this is not even safe to say here. I don't know what it's like here, but in our local congregation, we have some homeschoolers, and in our communities, has been in the past a fairly prevalent thing. And for my wife and I, we would have never considered that. And I've always rooted for the church school. I think that there's a lot of blessings that come there that are difficult to be found in homeschool. If you chose to homeschool, my hat's off to you. A lot of hard work. I bless you in that. But as our church school, something was happening, and we were having more and more families choosing to homeschool. But there's something that I noticed as I talked with these brethren, that it wasn't so much that they had a vision for the homeschool, and so they wanted to take their children and do a better job in homeschool than what they were doing at church. It was rather that they felt like the program at school, it didn't matter how good of a teacher we had, the program at school was just not really going where they were doing what they were concerned for their children for, what they wanted. As a board, as we were looking at this, working with our pastoral team, we seen that we need to take some proactive measures to deal with this. We sat down, we spent many hours drafting a mission and vision statement. And for those of you that know me personally, you know that this has been a pet peeve of mine for years in business. How many businesses operate without a mission statement and a vision statement and a set of core values? What do we really stand for? After writing many pages and condensing many pages, this is what we came up with for whatever it's worth. Our mission is to provide a Christ-centered school that assists parents in educating their children in social skill, character, and core character development and the core academics. Our vision is to see young men, Christian men and women, that find true joy in daily life and are well prepared to meet the opportunities and challenges of 21st century kingdom building. Our core values are: each child will be respected as an individual and viewed as a recruit for the kingdom. Teachers will be carefully chosen and prepared for the challenges of training and teaching young individuals for God's kingdom. We commit to work in harmony with the parents of the students assisting them in educating their children. The atmosphere will be carefully guarded and structured to maintain a safe environment for the students. Now you might say, well, it doesn't take that much to put some words down on paper. And you know, nowadays with technology, it's very easy. In fact, you can probably find this online and you can go copy and paste. And let me tell you, just drafting a vision statement and a mission statement and a set of core values for your school, just having that draft and having that written on paper somewhere in a file in your archive somewhere is not what it takes. Let me tell you, it's the process that you go through in drafting those, if you're serious about it, is what does something. The agonizing that we went through in trying to draft these words into something that made sense, that really captured the vision, the burden that we had as a school board and as pastors and those that were concerned in the community, it forced us to work together to really stop and think, where are we going? What are we doing? Why do we have school? That process for us was priceless. After going through that process, the challenge of meeting our budget diminished significantly, at least for the first year or two. If you want to know what happened later, come to the next session. When we as a board, as pastors, as community leaders, cannot clearly articulate to our people what school's about, much, much more is going to suffer than just the finances. But the finances will suffer. We need to understand that education is a means to an end. It's not an end in itself. Now, that's a nice little saying. We've all heard sayings like that before. What does that really mean for us in shoe leather? What does it really mean to you as a businessman, to you as an organization leader, to you on the mission field, to you pastors? What does this really mean in real life? I grew up in, as I said, in Central America, and I seen many missionaries come and go. My father and mother moved there in 69 and lived there for 22 years. 11 of us children were born there. I'm blessed to have one of my sisters with me here today. And in those years, what we've seen of missionaries coming and going and those that came and stayed, it made a profound impact on how I thought about finances. And this is what I've seen. There was basically three types of missionaries that came to the mission field. And I'm talking mostly now from a financial perspective, but it dovetails into every area of our lives. The first type is a man and a woman that God called, or maybe it's a single person, someone that God called to the mission field to serve, to preach the gospel, and to reach lost souls. And they had a very clear vision and a mission in doing this. And the amount of time that they planned to spend in doing this was going to keep them from being able to hold a steady job. Very well. There's businesses, there's people with pocketbooks that opened up and they stood behind those people and they supported the cause. Well done. The second group, and this might sound a little harsh, but the second group was a group of people that they were not doing well financially where they were in whatever state in the U.S. And they found themselves kind of a misfit. They were kind of at odds with their church, and they were at the end of the rope financially. And they kept hearing about sponsored missionaries, and it just seemed like a real easy out. They showed up on the mission field. Everything looked good on the surface. The blessing of the church was there. Everything as far as the formality of it was there. But can you imagine the problem that created on the mission field? And then there's a third group. There's the group of people that were businessmen and were entrepreneurs in this country, and they seen the opportunities and the possibilities of moving to one of those mission fields and to starting a business, some type of venture, maybe milking 10 cows, it don't matter what it was, but being self-supported and being involved with the local people and through business reach out to the local communities around them. Be the first or be the last, but let's not have schools that produce the middle, the second one. There's different reasons for going into business. There's a lot of businessmen here. Think back to when you made the choice and the decision to go into business. What motivated you? Why didn't you just choose to be an employee at the local lumber yard or milk hand at the farm or carpenter at the mini barn shop? There's something that motivated you to move beyond that and to start your own business and to move forward. It burdens me how many times in our circles, amongst the Anabaptist people that the reason for going in business, now we would never say this publicly, but the reason for going into business for myself is very simply consumerism. I want more money so I can spend more money. I think as a group, as a people, we need to be preparing our first graders to be thinking in terms of 21st century kingdom builders. We need to help them understand how to use math for the kingdom. We need to help them understand how working with their hands, everything they do, it's not for themselves. Joy comes from giving. And that's why the wellsprings of grace and joy from the Lord are never ending, because it's not from consuming. You can always give more, but you can't always get more. Maybe all that you have left, if you're in poverty, that you can give is a smile. But a smile can travel a long ways and can do great wonders. What are we doing as a people? What are we doing in our schools to help prepare the next group of kingdom builders? Back to the businessmen, the ex-students that you hire in your place of business. I've noticed over the years, I never had the opportunity of being an employee for anyone other than my father. And when I got married, I went off on my own. And so I was, most of my career, I've been on the other side of the fence. Can be a very difficult side of the fence to be on. But I have noticed with great interest of some of the important things that need to be asked in doing an interview for a hire. And I have kept somewhat of a record of what your education level is and then what your performance is at work. And we heard this morning that there's, yes, you might have only went to fourth grade and you might have grown a large business. You might have been very successful as a missionary. There's, yes, that can happen. But should that be our plan? Should that be what we plan to do as a people? Or should we prepare our people to move forward? Should we prepare the next batch of kingdom builders for the work that's out there? In closing, I would just like to leave something with you that I have found in doing these interviews that really stands out to me. It's one of the only things that I have found to be consistent all the way through, that if they have that, they're probably going to be successful. Now, granted, if they didn't have much education, I probably won't have them be my accountant. You know, there's different jobs that require different talents. But I'm talking about for whatever job that you have in the company, that you'll probably end up being successful. And the one thing is that you respect your parents. One of the top questions that I like to ask, and I have to do this in not a direct way, I want to find out what you think of your dad. You might love your mom, but what do you think about your dad? And I have found that if you have a high respect for your dad, if you love your dad, you're probably going to be the type of a person that's an asset in the community and not a liability. You're going to be an asset in the business. You are going to be a kingdom builder. I would just like for you to think about that. In our next session, for those of you that will be attending, I want to zero in really on the budget part of it. And when I was asked to share this, I might have went way off track in what you were looking for when it said budgeting, but I think this whole thing is a package. We cannot look at the financial side without looking at the whole. The financial side is just stuff. It's just a thing in the grand scope. Think about how we deal with patrons in our school that are not interested. Back to the blueberry story. We don't have perfect blueberries. We cannot send patrons that have that critical attitude. We can't just send them away. We have to work with them. We have problem students at school. We can't just send them away. We don't want to just send them away. We work with them. And so we live in a real life. May God help us as we deal with the realities of life and the pressures that we face. God bless.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.